director of clinical training is in. Welcome to the DCT podcast, your portable meeting with a director of clinical training. I'm Joel Hughes, the DCT for the clinical psychology program at a Midwestern university. This is private social media, so this podcast is not endorsed by my program, department, or university. My views are my own. In this episode, I'll tell you about my story of work-life imbalance, and then I'll list some specific things that you can do to improve work-life balance. So what about the DCT, dear listener? Well, for me, I have never had a major life role in which I did not feel overwhelmed, at least some of the time. For example, during college, at least once in every semester, I would reach a breaking point where just things seemed to stack up and it was just very hard. In my marriage, I've been married for about 26 years. Sometimes are good, sometimes are very hard. Is that work-life imbalance? Absolutely. What about parenthood? I used to think that I was very busy when I was in graduate school, and then I had a child during graduate school. And then I learned about the joy of deciding whether or not to have a sandwich or take a shower, because you didn't have time for both. Yes, I've tried eating a sandwich in the shower. Kill two birds with one stone. And then, of course, back to graduate school, when I was getting my master's degree, I was very stressed out by the thesis. We had a thesis proposal meeting, and at that meeting, it was decided that I could not do that thesis, and so I had to try over again, and I learned for my dissertation and my PhD program that you must always have a backup plan. In case your first dissertation proposal fails at the proposal meeting, it's time to get a new proposal put together very quickly. Of course, during my doctoral education, I had constant job anxiety because I knew that it was a bleak prospects for anyone to get a job in a tenure track line in psychology. And I also, of course, had the constant feeling of not accomplishing enough. Then I went on the job search, the job anxiety continued. I did not get a lot of job offers. I did not get a lot of interviews. Some of the postdoctoral fellows that I've worked with here at Kent State University, whether they were working with me or with my colleagues, have also experienced a lot of stress during the job search. Some of them have gotten outstanding tenure track jobs. Other people, you know, are struggling to get the job that's a good fit for them. And so the job search is a stressful time. And does that eat into your personal life? Absolutely. And then, of course, there's the early career life of the psychologist. Whether you're on the faculty or in a clinical role or in industry, it can seem overwhelming at first. And then, of course, even when you're not early career, I'm a full professor. I'm the director of clinical training, la-di-da. Well, writing the damn APA self-study was so hard. I worked all day, every day for some of the summer on that. It was terrible. So what am I trying to say? I think it's normal to be stressed out and overwhelmed sometimes. This is not a sign of weakness or failure. What am I doing? I'm using my ACT, my acceptance and commitment concepts. I know I'm dumbing it down, but broadly, can we have the stressed out feeling and accept that this is a normal part of being in an extreme knowledge environment, juggling multiple roles? And can we stay committed to our values and accept that commitment to our values is going to cause some strain? I think I have firm values. For example, I refuse to let my professional identity be my entire identity as a human being. So work is work, and it has to stay in its place. And I've done this since graduate school. I'm going to admit this in front of everybody, I only work 40 or 50 hours a week. And that's been true since leaving graduate school. I know that the national surveys show that faculty generally work about 60 hours a week, but I'm not. And I believe that the occupational literature will show that going beyond 50 hours is counterproductive, and you're going to get into making up work to do and just being busy for busy's sake. And if this means that I'm less successful, so be it. You know, don't get me wrong, I do work hard. My late father said that your wheat has to grow as high as any other farmer's, or else that's shameful. So when I work, I work. To do otherwise would violate the social contract that I have with the profession, with the university, with the students, and with society. After all, universities are supposed to contribute to the common good. That's why we have universities. And so I do work hard, but I will not be exhaustively defined by my job. And I've said before that when I retire, you will not be able to find me. I'm not just going to come back and sit in my office for the rest of my life, because I have a much bigger life beyond just being on the faculty. And the way this relates to students is that sometimes when I'm meeting with a stressed out student, I remind them that they were once successful professionals before they got to graduate school. Sometimes they had another career for years between college and graduate school. But coming back into graduate school and assuming the role of student again, sometimes that makes people feel a lot of pressure or that they're not as valued as they used to be. And I just remind people that, you know, you're a top scholar, you're an A-lister, you're in the top 1%, you know, you're in a PhD program in psychology, you are a successful professional, don't forget that. And to be honest, sometimes the culture in graduate school can be too hierarchical and can deny graduate students the respect that they deserve for being all-around winners at life. Well, those are values, and I say reject those values. Sometimes you have to put up with the institutional culture for a while, I get it, but, you know, fight the system. And at least in the way that you see yourself and the way that you feel, you can reject the values of an institution and accept your own values instead, that you are a valuable person and that you do have a professional identity and a personal identity and that they're not identical. And what you do with those values, we'll get to in a little bit. Anyway, I've made a lot of progress in my work-life synergy, and I have a ways to go. One of the things I wish I had done differently was to have more fun along the way. I regret not having taken advantage of the places that I've lived. I lived in Colorado to get my master's degree. How many times did I go skiing? Zero. How many times did I go fishing? One time. And so, yeah, I missed out. I mean, why did I run subjects for my thesis during the Super Bowl on a Sunday? I mean, on the one hand, I needed to finish my thesis, but in hindsight, that might have been overcommitment. On the other hand, when I got to my doctoral program, I always had more friends and more contacts in the community than I did in the program. And so I tried, at least. I got married. I had a kid. I tried to expand my world beyond the program and to develop some kind of work-life synergy, although I wouldn't have called it that at the time because I made that term up this week and then realized that I had stolen it from, I guess, the interwebs. But don't expect to get there right away. So as an aside, how vulnerable should you be in your writing, in your speaking, in your podcasting? I mean, this podcast is not psychotherapy, so self-disclosure is fine. My bias is to be so vulnerable that you're a little bit worried or embarrassed. That's just my bias. But to me, that makes things far more interesting than the dry, boring textbook approach. So it's time for some action items. What can we take home and do from this journey through the work-life balance literature, small as it is for doctoral students in psychology? Well, number one, I would say, starting from that new definition of work-life balance, I would say work from your values. Toward that end, examine your values. Don't just absorb them. Remember when you were in college and one of the values that you were supposed to absorb was that you had to be a straight-A student and you had to be a top scholar and you had to rule the school? Well, that value was supposed to fade away after your undergraduate years. I like to tell students that if you're getting straight A's in graduate school, you're failing because you're not doing enough research and you're not getting enough hours for internship. It's really not worth it to read every word of every article anymore. And so don't just absorb the values of the water around you. Rather, think about it and then make some firm work-life boundaries. And toward that end, I did say that I don't really take home work and that I tend to work 40 or 50 hours a week is all. And I'm just not going to do more. I take off all of spring break. I take off most of Christmas break. And I also tell my students, you know, you need to be gone for some of Christmas break. I'm not going to talk to you during spring break. There are times that academics is a sprint. And then at the end of the sprint, you rest. It's not really a marathon. It's a sprint. So sprint through each semester and then rest when you can. And make some boundaries around that so that you're not just permanently on call. Number two, I would say have a physical academic planner so that you can be very organized and live with intention instead of reactively. Yeah, I know. I'm constantly arguing that people need to have a physical academic planner. It's kind of an obsession of mine, and we'll do a deeper dive on that in the future because I am the evangelist of the planner, and I'll get into my autobiography on why I think that's true in the future. But for now, let me just say, be organized. If you have a fully digital system and it's a Keystone habit that you constantly are checking, that's fine. If you have a hybrid system with a physical academic planner and a digital calendar, for example, that's fine. But for most people, having a physical academic planner so that you can see the context of all the things that you are supposed to do and so that you can have everything written down on paper, that's really a great way to get organized and live with some intention. Thirdly, have flexible expectations. Now, I didn't say to lower your expectations, so no hate email. I said flexible expectations because what I'm going to argue that you can achieve a career that honors your purpose, but not always your passion, which is to say you may not get your dream job, but you will get a job in which you can fulfill your calling. For example, you do not have to be a tenure-track professor at a research-extensive university. That's what you had to say when you were doing the graduate school interview, possibly. And many faculty in doctoral programs believe that they're only training future faculty. But as we heard earlier, 60% of the graduate students who try to transition to an academic job fail to do so. And so the job market is just not as good as the aspirations of doctoral students. And besides that fact of psychology right now, and all of academics, frankly, I have a long-winded, boring discussion of the issue of purpose in the book that I wrote, Psychology Pathways. I'm just going to read some of it to you because I think it pretty conclusively makes the case that purpose trumps passion when it comes to pursuing a career. Billionaire Mark Cuban, owner of the Dallas Mavericks basketball team and investor on the TV show Shark Tank, said, "One of the great lies of life is follow your passions." He argues that you should follow your effort. He has a brief video on Amazon for the Insights for Entrepreneurs series, in which he suggests that whatever you'll try really hard at is something you'll become really good at, and that it's really fun to be very good at something. He said that he had a passion for basketball, but he didn't have the talent. He said he had a 7-inch vertical leap. Well, now he owns a team. So eventually, he found a way to indulge his passion, but not as a player. So is he right? Well, insightful author Cal Newport also said that you should not follow your dreams. In his book, So Good They Can't Ignore You, Why Skills Trump Passion in the Quest for Work You Love, he expands his thesis in what's basically a book-length argument that career satisfaction comes from being good at your work, having some control over what you do, and having a sense that your work is meaningful. So he's also a proponent of the idea that following your dreams is not the right plan. Is he right? Well, sociologist Tim Clydesdale wrote The Purposeful Graduate, Why Colleges Must Talk to Students About Vocation, and that makes a similar point. He analyzed the effects of programs at 88 colleges and universities that had been funded by about $250 million in grants from the Lilly Endowment to encourage students to consider the purpose of their life and their education. Now, some were religious schools, but many were not. And in Dr. Clydesdale's analysis, these programs had been a resounding success because students who can articulate a purpose build better lives than those who didn't reflect on their purpose to come up with some kind of clear calling for their education and their lives. He often found that students who didn't take time to reflect on their purpose often had shallow motives, like make a lot of money, that led to less satisfying lives than those with a more thoughtful purpose, such as, provide sustainable agriculture practices to the poor in rural India. So purpose was important, and there's $250 million of proof reported in his book. So what is a purpose? According to eminent psychologist William Damon, a purpose is a stable and generalized intention to accomplish something that is at the same time meaningful to the self and consequential for the world beyond the self. Let's break that down. A purpose is, 1, pursuing meaningful accomplishments that, 2, have positive consequences for the world beyond yourself. You could call this serving the public good, which again is what universities were originally thought to accomplish. So the thing that I'm trying to land on here is that this truism of college, that purpose is better than dream job, that honoring your values and your calling is better than getting exactly to the job title you want, why would that evaporate when you get to graduate school? it does persist into graduate school and beyond. And so, again, don't lower your expectations, but start to have some flexible expectations. I don't know anybody that's doing exactly what they thought they were going to do. If it were up to me, I'd be at a university on the West Coast that had an academic medical center, but I'm not. I'm in the Midwest, and there is no academic medical center at Kent State University. And I'm fine with that now, because I can still do the kind of work that I want to do. And to be honest, if I had ended up in human resources or social psychology or economics or biostatistics, I would still be as happy as I am right now. Don't get me wrong. I love being the director of clinical training, and I like being a health service psychologist. But I've come to the conclusion that if you can live with purpose and articulate how your work is meaningful and contributes to the public good, then you're going to be happy in your career, even if it isn't the exact job title that you wanted. So fourth, socially construct a positive professional identity. Why? So that you're at least happy at work. You see, some professions have low self-esteem as a profession. And so if you read their journals, they're writing about professional identity and how to have a better professional identity and how to silence the oppressor within and get past their imposter complex. And some of these professions include nursing and academic advising and teaching faculty. Because teaching faculty often started as doctoral students that thought they were going to be research faculty, and they end up as teaching faculty, which is not what they had originally intended to do. And fortunately, there's a recent article called Developing a Teacher Identity in the University Context, a Systematic Review of the Literature in Higher Education Research and Development in 2017. And this is great for us because we can learn what are the components that lead to a positive professional identity. And so factors contributing to the development of a professional identity in university teachers were contact with students, which is to say doing the work, and staff development programs. And I would not hold my breath that there's going to be staff development programs for you as a graduate student in health service psychology, although you do have the DCT podcast. Yeah. On the other hand, the wider context of higher education was experienced as having a constraining effect on the development of a positive professional identity. Why? I can imagine that teaching faculty are less valued, at least they feel that way, than research faculty at many universities. And so the context of higher education was having a negative effect on their ability to form a positive professional identity. So what this means for us is that we're going to need to consider the contextual factors affecting higher education and health service psychology in order to mitigate the potentially constraining effects of these influences on the development of our positive professional identities. Moving on, there were five psychological processes involved in the development of professional identities of university teachers. And they were a sense of appreciation. In other words, do people appreciate what you do? A sense of connectedness or a sense of community that you get. Number three, a sense of competence or being good at what you do. Number four, a sense of commitment. And number five, imagining a future career trajectory. I think the implications of these are obvious. Even now in graduate school, start feeling appreciated, become connected with other people, become good at what you do, because rare, valuable skills are what's going to give you competence. Have a sense of commitment to the profession, to yourself, to your colleagues, and imagine a future career trajectory with flexible expectations. I'll just throw that in. So that was the fourth one. Let's socially construct a positive professional identity as health service psychologists. And then five, and finally, try to leverage health service psychology to get the synergy that I'm arguing for. Use your powers of health service psychology to improve your non-work life, and use your non-work life to energize your vocational pursuits. Consider the auto mechanic. I have a friend in North Carolina who's an auto mechanic. Is there any sense in which being an auto mechanic as a profession can enrich his home life, his personal life, his hobbies? Well, absolutely. He has a skill set that he learns at work that he can take home and use for fun and profit. All of his cars run really, really well. He's able to build interesting things like a backyard barbecue and a portable barbecue. He's able to restore a Jeep. He's able to buy a car very cheaply because he knows how to fix it. And in one case, he had a minivan that he bought that was an all-wheel drive minivan, but the all-wheel drive had been repaired many times, and it was becoming clear that you just can't repair the all-wheel drive in this minivan. But since he was a mechanic, he was able to disconnect the rear wheels and have just a regular front-wheel drive minivan, which is what most minivans are, and he can't give that back to a customer because that violates kind of the ethics and the warranty and stuff like that. So he was able to acquire this minivan very cheaply and then convert it into a front-wheel drive minivan and keep it for personal use. And he and his family drove that for a couple hundred thousand miles because, as you might imagine, his cars were very well maintained. And in addition, he used his income from being an auto mechanic, which was considerable, to, you know, do all the stuff that he wanted to do in his personal life. What about his personal life? Was he able to use his personal life to enrich his professional life? Well, he would bring to work some of the things that he created, such as his portable smoker, and he would use his interests in the culinary arts to smoke things in the shop. And then at lunchtime, when most people are going out to, you know, spend money on fast food, he and his friends, the auto mechanics, would sit around eating, you know, gourmet smoked meats and having a wonderful time on their lunch break. They saved time, they saved money, and they ate better than the salespeople and the other people that work at the dealership. And so that's just a little bit of an example. But my point is that if you have some way of combining your professional life and your personal life to achieve a greater result in both, that's what I'm talking about with synergy. So are there any skills that psychology graduate students learn which could be used to improve their effectiveness at both work and home? I'll bet there are, and I'll bet we can identify them. One of them is research. One of my favorite things about being a research professor is that I have a world-class academic library at my hands, and I've been trained in how to find articles. And so you'll notice today that we saw some systematic reviews and meta-analyses, because those are the gold nuggets that will get you to the heart of the issue very quickly. I used my research skills to read and understand and interpret what these various articles were saying. And so, yeah, even for something that affects my personal life, which is to say work-life balance, I'm able to use the fact that I can very quickly get up to speed in the research literature to improve that. What about clinical skills? Everyone in health service psychology is trained in clinical skills. And just because it's not a therapy room doesn't mean that those clinical skills are worthless. Speaker-listener technique. Try it sometime with your significant other. Catch someone doing something right. Try your positive parenting techniques on everybody. These things really work. If we believe that they work, why not use them in our life? Even things like tolerance. We have a high tolerance for extreme knowledge work, and we have skill at balancing many competing demands. And so the fact that we're in a high-pressure profession should help us outside of our professional life, in our personal life, where we will also find high pressure in multiple roles and sometimes extreme knowledge. Well, are there psychological principles that undergird the effectiveness of our work and home? I'll bet we can identify those too. For example, in psychology, we learn about interpersonal effectiveness. The things that you learn in your marriage therapy class that Gottman discovered about turning toward, turning away, those sorts of things, those are true. Those are true in the therapy room, and they're also true in your life. And so you can use that stuff, lift it directly out of your training, and take it home and use it. Our distress tolerance, we know about distress tolerance and the importance of being able to accept and commit to our values, even if things aren't exactly how we like. We know about the psychological principle of behavioral self-monitoring, which accounts for a certain percentage of the treatment effect of all interventions. And so this is true for you too. If you would like to eat less or exercise more or sleep better, anything that you start monitoring is going to get better, generally speaking. We also know about the cognitive science of learning. We know about repeated rehearsal and spaced practice instead of massed practice. These things are so true. Just do things the right way. This will increase your efficiency at work, and then that will help you have more margin for your personal life. We also know about the importance of sleep. Since we're scientists, we can read the research on sleep, and we see that high-performance sleep, which is to say a high sleep efficiency and more energy, is a big part of the time management puzzle, which we'll get to in the future. We also understand energy management, and we know how to figure out what the literature is going to show. We can understand the literature from industrial organizational psychology and business that says that after about 50 hours a week of work, additional time on task does not really increase productivity. And there are many others. These are just some examples, but there's going to be many, many examples of psychological principles that I think we can learn at work and then take home immediately, and that we can achieve a synergy of our work and our non-work lives to get a better result in both. So in conclusion, what I'm suggesting is that graduate students in health service psychology often struggle with work-life balance, just like everybody else. But we can disambiguate the balance construct to discover that work-life synergy might be a better approach. And finally, graduate students in health service psychology are perfectly positioned to capitalize on professional skills and knowledge of psychological science to achieve the synergy that I am proposing. Okay, final thought. What have we done here today?
I know.
Okay, Siri, what?
I'm not Siri.
Whatever. What did our discussion illustrate?
We used research and principles of psychological science to better understand work-life balance and generate ideas for flourishing in graduate school and in our personal lives through synergy.
Well said. The podcast itself was an exercise in the kind of synergy that I'm proposing. We consulted the literature. We defined work-life balance more carefully. This helped us acknowledge areas of work-life balance that we did not cover, and we came away with some action items to try right away. We've tried to cover work-life balance between graduate school and non-work life. We have not covered balance within the program, given multiple roles of student, researcher, manager, writer, teacher, etc. We have also not discussed the impetus for much of the literature on work-life balance, specifically the burden that women face by typically assuming a greater responsibility for childcare and domestic duties than men. We also have not addressed the crisis in mental health that people have been writing about in graduate education, where it's suggested that as many as 40% of graduate students have diagnosable depression. Well, dear listener, these topics will have to wait for a future podcast. Thanks for listening to the DCT podcast. If you want to contact me, email me at jhughes1@kent.edu. More disclaimer, the podcast does not establish a supervisory relationship, blah, blah, blah. Disclaimer, my views are my own. Disclaimer. If my views contradict those of your DCT or your advisor, you can ignore me. Remember, not all DCTs are your DCT. If you enjoyed the show, rate it on iTunes or Spotify, and don't tell your friends, unless they're graduate students in health service psychology.